Welcome back, everybody, to another episode of the JMO Podcast. I'm your host, Taylor Michaels, and our guest this episode, we've got Hunter Nitti, NWT Pro. Now, Hunter, it's his first time on. We get to know him a whole bunch in this episode. He's a Minnesota guy, and right now he's leading the points race in the NWT's Angler of the Year category after three events so far in this 2024 regular season. So this interview, we're going to get to know Hunter. We're going to talk fishing, of course. He's a forward sonar specialist. And yeah, just a really, really fun, really informational podcast here with one of the best guys out there doing it right now. So let's get into it. We've got Hunter Nitti. Check out the Flopbox bait coolers from Flop Industries. The Flopbox 10 and Flopbox 20 are heavy-duty, roto-molded bait coolers, fully insulated, which comes into play both summer and winter. The aeration system for minnows and other live bait is fully enclosed and lithium-powered for reliability and durability. The stainless hardware, the removable chill plate, the list goes on of features, but these high-end bait coolers can easily enhance your fishing experience when you consider their ability to keep your bait alive, fresh, and ready to go when you need it. Check out the Flopbox bait coolers and more at flopindustries.com. That link is in the description of this podcast. If you have any fishing memory or a fish that you would like to commemorate with a replica, or you have questions about getting fish replicas done, reach out to Jamie Rizavi from Rizavi Taxidermy Studio in New Rockford, North Dakota. Jamie and his crew do next level work here at the JMO headquarters. We are blessed to have so many replicas made by Jamie. Reach out. You can find him on social media or online at RizaviTaxidermyStudio.com. The link is in the description of this podcast. All right, Hunter, let's get into this, man. We got all kinds of things we could talk about. Your fishing season this year is going pretty great. I think we can say it that way. And I'm excited to get in all that. But this is the first time having you on, man. So, and you and I have never met. We've never talked. I got to get to know you a little bit. Where does this all start for you, man? Where are you from? How did you get into fishing?
Yeah, so I'm actually from Rosemont, Minnesota, just south of the Twin Cities. I mean, there's not a whole lot of lakes or much fishing going on down here. I mean, it's all in the northern part of the state. And my grandparents growing up, they own a resort on Mille Lacs Lake on the east side called Nitti's Hunter's Point. And they, when my dad was younger or in his mid-20s, they bought this resort, and my dad got into fishing pretty hard, and it kind of got the whole family into fishing pretty hard. You know, they had that occasional one family trip a year, fishing trip a year to the boundary waters. But now it turned into something that we all love and we all enjoy, and we do it every weekend or every day that we can.
Hunter Nitti, Nitti's Hunter Resort. I mean, who was the resort named after you, or were you named after the resort?
Most people, I usually just say, yeah, that's how it goes, because it's a story. But no, the point, Hunter's Point, was named that originally. So the resort before my grandparents bought it was Hunter's Point Resort, and then they just threw the Nitti in when they bought it, and then it ended up coming along that now my dad had a son named Hunter, and it kind of all matched up.
Like, at what point in time did you feel like you had a home body of water, or do you still feel like you're kind of a nomad in that way? I mean, tournament fish, that's a big part of tournament fishing, is being able to travel to fish. And it's amazing how people that grow up not necessarily close to water or any particular marquee body of water, you know, I guess guys that I've talked to, you know, it tends to make people travel well, just because that's just kind of how it was forever. How would you explain that? I mean, did you, when you started making trips to Mille Lacs, is Mille Lacs your home body of water? Mississippi River can't be too far away? Or have you always just kind of felt like you were one of those guys that was a traveling angler?
Yeah, it was, you know, Mississippi River's not far. I mean, I'm only 35 minutes from where I sit right now from the Mississippi River, but I was never a river guy, and I had too much ADHD to go figure that out. So, when I was younger, it was like, all right, we'll go up to grandma and grandpa's every weekend, and we'd fish during the weekend. And I'm like, well, and so like Mille Lacs was my stomping grounds, but It kind of like wasn't. I mean, it was every other weekend this, and then we'd go to Lake of the Woods or Lake Winnemagosh. And so, I mean, really then in that point in my time in my life when I was younger, not even old enough to drive, it was more Lake Winnemagosh was kind of my stomping grounds. But then you go home and you didn't have anything around you to really fish walleyes. You could fish some bass. And I was like, I don't like this, you know? And then I told my grandpa, I'm like, hey, I think I'm going to stay with you for the summer. And just threw a wild idea at him. And that's kind of how my summers went when I was younger. You know, I couldn't even drive, but I loved to fish. If you gave me a dock, I'd be on it all day. I mean, you couldn't get me off. I wouldn't eat all day. Grandma would bring me down food. And I mean, it was, that's kind of how it went. And my summers were just spent up at Mille Lacs. So that, yeah, Mille Lacs was really my stomping grounds. And then I would travel with my dad because he fished Minnesota tournament trail tournaments. And
okay.
I'd travel with him and we'd kind of travel to different lakes. But, you know, I was just kind of hanging out. They'd pre-fish and then fish their tournament. And I'd sit on the dock all day and be the happiest kid in the world.
Yeah, I mean, okay, so that's how you got exposed to tournaments then, obviously. I mean, I kind of want to talk about that little bit of transition in your life. Like, how old were you when tournaments started to become a thing?
Yeah, man, probably like when I was about 14 or 15 years old, my grandpa bought me my first boat. It was a Lund Rebel, and he kind of used it as a rental boat at the resort up north. And when I was there, I got to use it. When I wasn't there, he would try to make some money off it. And so he bought me this Rebel, and I'd go out fishing all the time. And I finally was like, I'm entering tournaments. I kept telling my dad, and he's like, nah. And then finally he was like, oh, here's a tournament. You can fish it with your mom. And I think I was 14, and me and my mom went out and fished this tournament, and I whooped everybody's butt. And they're like,
on Mille Lacs?
On Mille Lacs, yeah.
Oh, wow.
And they're like, what the heck? And it was a tough bite, and we just got lucky, honestly. I threw an anchor and started throwing bobbers like anybody would do, the easiest thing you can do. And that was kind of my, that was my first tournament. And then after that, it was, I worked my butt off to try to find anybody that would fish a tournament with me. And, you know, I'd talk to some guy, anybody that had a boat that wasn't fishing the tournament that weekend, I'd pimp them. As a little kid, just, hey, let's fish it. And I didn't have any money when I was a kid. And my grandpa was, like all kids, we had a piggy bank. But my grandpa was all for it. He's like, yeah, Jake Hunter, I'll pay for the tournament. So I'd hop in with all these guys and not a clue really where we were going, what we were doing, and just go fishing.
Learning how to fish the day and just go fish the conditions. I mean, you got to look back on that and think, wow, like that is a huge payoff for the way things are now, right? I mean, guys, you got to be able to go out there and move and groove and not grow roots anywhere. I mean, so you probably already saw yourself molding or forming into the angler that you are today back then.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. I mean, back then I was full into it as full into it as I am now. It was the only thing I did, the only thing I wanted to do. And fishing nowadays is, yeah, it's a lot different. It's a totally different, all of us had to kind of adapt to a forward facing sonar thing. And I still love the old back in the day spot on a spot, or you would do this on a spot and you'd sit in this angle and cast at this angle. I mean, I still miss all those things. Lindy rigging down the side of a flat. I mean, I love them things. They made me the angler that I am today, learning fish without legit seeing them like we can nowadays.
You've been doing this a while. I think that's one interesting part of your story this year. And, you know, I'll fully admit, like, I'm a big fan of tournament fishing, and, you know, I have been for a few years now anyways, but I don't know everybody. I mean, I don't attend those events, so I don't see everybody. I don't know everybody, and I feel like, you know, like this year, especially in the NWT, the success you've had in the NWT, and you're kind of in your sophomore season of it, but you've been tournament fishing for your whole life. I mean, you know, like that, from the sounds of it. So, I mean, I'm kind of interested in all of those stories going back. When did fishing really, do you feel like, take a big leap? Or was it gradual the whole time to where we're at today? Or are there some marquee memories or experiences, tournament experiences, that you feel like, you know, have really, you know, helped you grow the most over the years?
Yeah. I mean, it was pretty gradual. You know, I fished a little bit of tournaments, fished a lot when I was really young. And then I guided muskies for a couple of years, just deckhanded with a guy. That was awesome. That was some of the most fun times of my life, guiding muskies all summer long. And then it was probably, I'd say 2017, 2018, when I finally found a full-time partner to fish a tournament circuit with me. And we fished, I don't even, probably 14, 15 tournaments that year.
Oh, wow. And
yeah, we did fairly well, but I always hated to lose. You know, we had really, really good tournaments, and especially on our home body of water, which was Mille Lacs. And then we go to Winnemagosh, and when my dad was younger, before my grandparents bought the cabin, that was, Winnemagosh was his home body of water. So we did really well on Winnemagosh. We did really well on Lake of the Woods. You know, I was really competitive in it. And I just, throughout the years, we did that, and I got more competitive in it. And I'm like, hey, I want to go fish a bigger circuit. I want to go fish against some other guys and gals. And so me and my uncle, and I want to say it was 2019 or 2020. I'm not for sure. We went and entered the Ames Pro Walleye Series. And we kind of figured, like, no, this is a big circuit. You know, this is a really respectable circuit. There's a lot of really heavy hitters on it. And we went and fished the Ames circuit for the first time, first year. And we ended up winning Team of the Year. And we won the championship that year. And that's what kind of really just, I really let loose after that. I'm like, hey, this is what I love to do. This is what I'm going to do. This is me. This is what I was born to do. And I'm not going to stop. And that's when I looked at it and like, I'm going to fish the national tour someday. And I'm going to go see if I can crush that. And I'm not going to fish it unless I know I can. You know, it's one of those things that I'm not going to enter the next stage unless I know I can. And so then I waited a couple of years, and then I entered the big stage, and that's kind of what got me to where I am today.
What do you remember about that first season with the Ames, or your Team of the Year? I mean, how did it, do a little recap of what you remember about that tournament. Where did you guys fish? How did you fish? What were some of the big takeaways there?
Yeah. I mean, we fished totally old school. It was cool as can be. I mean, you'd find fish on 2D and you go Lindy rig them, or you go pull cranks through them. And I mean, we couldn't do anything wrong. You know, I fished with my uncle Tony, and I was a really great fisherman, and he was too, but I was sitting there. I mean, I was sticking them, and he was really good at, hey, we got to go. We got to go to the next spot. He was always really good at, hey, we'd bounce ideas off each other so good. And that year, bouncing ideas off each other, we couldn't fail, you know? I mean, and that's the biggest thing that you got to have in a partner, is you got to be able to bounce ideas off each other, and you got to be able to count on one another. And we did. And that year, we couldn't fail. And it was a full non-forward facing sonar year. So I get to say that, hey, I had a big year without that. You know, some guys look at it nowadays like, oh, these guys can't do it without forward facing sonar. But truthfully, I can. And I proved I can for years. And that's that year was awesome. But then the next year, forward facing sonar came out. And then the next year, it was just horrible. Like, guys like me and other guys, my old man, and we could fish the old style really well. I mean, really, really, really well. And we're getting our butts kicked. And we're like, we got to learn forward-facing sonar now. And this is a whole nother ball game. And
I think 2021 was probably the worst year of fishing I ever had in my life.
You mean just for finishes? Like just for your finishes or the fishing?
Fishing was great. If I was going old school and I was going out fun fishing, I mean, fishing was great. If I was going into tournaments, and I would go into these tournaments pre-fishing, I would just forward facing sonar because I put it in my brain that, hey, I got to learn this or I'm not going to win. And I'm here to win. You know, I can go fish old style and take six behind five guys that are using forward facing sonar in front of me. I mean, I look back at it now and I was like, hey, if I just fished old style and rolled how I know, I would have done great. I would have done fine that year, but I probably went to one. And that's why I put my head down that year and I tried to learn forward facing sonar. And honestly, it was tough. It was, and I look at it now and I'm teaching guys now how to use it. And I could tell for them, it's tough. And I know because I had a full year that it was tough for me to learn forward facing sonar. I mean, really, really tough. And it was a really bad year. My finishes were horrible. I was bombing tournaments. I was coming in from tournaments on Leech Lake that I forward facing sonar the whole time. And I weighed one fish on a easy five fish bite, you know?
I definitely want to talk about that for sure. But before we leave, you know, like old school fishing, there's still so many people out there that, you know, live bait rigging. I'm super curious because I've never felt like I was on a high level rigging live bait. Because I just, you know, there's definitely levels to this stuff. But when you look back, you know, rigging bait and some of the successes that you've had, you know, I'm sure, you know, just all the learning experiences, people that you learned from, what do you feel like is the difference when you're a bait rigger? You know, when you just kind of reflect on those days in your career, like what are the things that you're doing to rig bait on a high level? Like how would you describe somebody that just rigs bait? Like, what are the details that you got to be paying attention to if you're going to be on a top level doing that?
Yeah, there's a lot. I mean, at some point in my life, and this is learning off of my dad, I think we were some of the best riggers there was around. You know, I could name a few more names that were incredible riggers. And the biggest thing to, and I wish we could go back to tournaments, just rig, but the biggest thing to rigging was knowing leader length. It was knowing what size weight you had to use in certain conditions. It was, well, I mean, the color hook mattered, and the hook was tiny, you know. There was so many things to it. I mean, I remember we rigged a lot of 4-pound test, and people thought we were nuts. They're like, you guys are nuts. I go, well, we're winning tournaments. Don't you think that's probably, there's a reason to it? And they're like, yeah, but you're rigging 4-pound test, catching 9-pounders. I'm like, you got to make them eat somehow. And the biggest thing to that was, is the 4-pound test, when you rigged bait on it, the bait could swim better. It could swim more natural than having 8-pound test where you had a little heavier line and the fish could see it a little better, and it controlled your minnow more. So, or your leech or your crawler. I mean, there's so many different factors to it, especially there's a lot of guys out there when you're rigging certain depths of water, they change their leaders when rigging bait. They, like red tails, you know, like I've been sitting next to a guy, he's got a 2-foot leader and he's just beating them up, and I'm sitting there with a 6-foot leader and I can't even get a bite. There were so many different factors to it. It literally comes down to a science.
Yeah, I find that stuff fascinating. And a lot of people do. I mean, I get so many requests on rigging bait, so I can never have a good bait rigger come through without asking you some of those questions. I think that's so true. You know, we have success at some point in our life with a particular setup, and then we just kind of carry that everywhere. And if the fish don't eat that setup everywhere, then it's their fault, right? I mean, you gotta be open-minded and you gotta be changing that stuff all the time. I think that light leader line makes a ton of sense. I mean, for leaders, were you guys fluorocarbon guys or mono guys?
We're pretty much fluorocarbon guys 100% of the time. We would just change lengths most of the time. You know, if you had a crawler, you could, and you wanted it to get off the bottom, you just used a worm blower. And I mean, a 12-foot leader, I remember times standing in the front of the boat and I'm like, holy moly, my leader's crazy long. I don't even know if I'm going to get this thing in the net.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I find that stuff fascinating too, especially when you know, like places like Mille Lacs or other bodies of water on the Great Lakes where the water is really clear and you got to be getting away from the boat. But also that long leader just to, for all those reasons. You got to have a good net man, and you really got to fight a fish when it's that far behind your weight.
Yeah, especially when you got like an 8 to 10 pounder on with 4 pound test. It gets a little crazy, and you're fighting that fish for a long time. But, you know, you can catch a 10 pounder on 4 pound test. It does work. I've caught a lot of them on it.
Check out the Flopbox bait coolers from Flop Industries. The Flopbox 10 and Flopbox 20 are heavy-duty, roto-molded bait coolers, fully insulated, which comes into play both summer and winter. The aeration system for minnows and other live bait is fully enclosed and lithium-powered for reliability and durability. The stainless hardware, the removable chill plate, the list goes on of features, but these high-end bait coolers can easily enhance your fishing experience when you consider their ability to keep your bait alive, fresh, and ready to go when you need it. Check out the Flopbox bait coolers and more at flopindustries.com. That link is in the description of this podcast. If you have any fishing memory or a fish that you would like to commemorate with a replica, or you have questions about getting fish replicas done, reach out to Jamie Rizavi from Rizavi Taxidermy Studio in New Rockford, North Dakota. Jamie and his crew do next level work here at the JMO headquarters. We are blessed to have so many replicas made by Jamie. Reach out. You can find him on social media or online at RizaviTaxidermyStudio.com. The link is in the description of this podcast. No, that's a great takeaway. But then definitely I want to talk a little bit about learning forward sonar, because I think everybody's journey in that, you know, everybody's on a journey with that right now. It's such a new technology. But talking about, you know, the tuition that you paid, that season where you just dedicated yourself to it, and it was just bomb after bomb. But man, you had to have been just learning crazy amounts. Like, you talk about going out on Leech Lake and weighing one fish in a day. Just because, I mean, what do you remember now, looking back? You know a lot more. What do you remember that was the most impactful learning experiences in some of those tournaments that you just bombed in?
Yeah, well, biggest thing I remember is that, especially that Leech Lake one. Before the tournament, I thought I could scope just like everybody else. I mean, it was 26 to 29 inchers. Like crazy. And I learned a lot in that tournament. After a few weeks after, if I do bad in a tournament, I sit on the couch and I will sit and think for hours and try to figure out, what the heck did I do wrong? Why did I not succeed? And that was one of those tournaments where it was pulling my hair out. And biggest thing that I learned in that one was I just didn't move enough. I didn't cover enough ground. And that's one of the biggest things with forward facing sonar that I see with a lot of people, is you look over and they're not covering ground. They're just sitting still and they're trying to look. And once you kind of get it down on what these fish look like, and once, like, what's a fish and what's not a fish, what's a rock, you can move. I mean, fast. You can move really fast. Turn that troll motor up to 10. And just scream. Go as fast as you can. Once you figure out what you're looking for, it gets pretty easy. And back then, I guess I didn't know what I was looking for. You know, I didn't know a whole lot of what was I doing. You know, I wasn't covering enough of ground. I was doing a lot of things wrong compared to what I know now. It's crazy.
What are some of the experiences where you started to unlock that code a little bit?
It was definitely, you know, what the things that I had dialed was, is I was such a good I was a good fisherman before that, and I knew how to find fish.
Yeah.
And I knew how to catch fish. And knowing how to find fish is, it's 90% of forward-facing sonar that a lot of people don't look at
right
in the world today, that they just say, oh, these guys can't fish without it. No, that 90% of it is knowing how to find fish. So I was really good at finding fish. I knowing how they set up, knowing windblown sides on where they'd load up on this point. And, you know, I'd throw the scope down and I'd look and there they'd be. And I was like, ooh, I knew it. And then the next day conditions would change and I didn't know how to find them again. You'd have a north wind crashing in on a point and I'm like, oh, they're right off the tip here. They're probably up a little bit shallower. And I'd see, and I go in there and, oh, there they are. And then the next day you'd have a south wind blowing off of it and they'd adjust off of it. And I kind of guess where they are. And then they'd spread out somewhere. And I just could not catch the spread out ones. I was really good at finding the schools. I was really good at, you know, just picking off where the big ones would lay. And it just kind of nowadays, now that I know how to scope and knowing what I know before scope is what makes you a really, really good scoper. Anybody can be really good at the electronic itself, but if you don't know what walleyes do and how they act and how they react to certain baits at certain times of the year, you're not going to catch them. I don't care who you are. You could be an all-star scoper, but you have to know all those things to win tournaments and be able to, you got to be able to adjust. There's so much to it. And that was kind of back then. I didn't know how to run the electronics. I didn't know how to dial in the settings. I was probably only looking like 30, 40 feet in front of me, which nowadays we can look like 250 feet. So I wasn't getting a full view of what I could see. You know, I was rolling around at 30 feet. Well, when you're rolling around at 30 feet, you're missing a ton.
Yeah, they could already be spooking from the boat, depending upon what body of water you're on.
Yeah, that's a huge thing too. You know, that's almost every body of water nowadays.
Yeah. Because
everybody's scoping. If you don't have that thing shooting out at 100, oh my gosh, like 80% of the fish, if you had it shooting out at 30, you'd never even see them.
Oh, that's been a huge learning curve for me. And I mean, like, it's so like humbling. It almost makes me depressed for how, you know, things that I tried to do before, you know, just the amount of hours on the water that I wasted, you know, just grinding out spots, staying on, you know, catching a nice fish on my first pass on a small spot, and then I catch that nice fish and it just holds me there for the next 4 hours, when even if there was more fish on that spot, I've blown them out already for, you know, 3.5 hours. It's like there ain't nothing left, and it's not realizing that it can be my fault, you know, like, oh my gosh. But I'm curious, you know, you talk about finding fish. There's something that I think is interesting with, you know, that tournament anglers kind of are forced to do that the everyday angler doesn't, you know, necessarily have to do on a daily basis. But, you know, evaluating and finding the right fish, you know, there's probably a lot of stories, you know, to go along with this, or I'm hoping anyways. But for you, you talk about like conditions when they switch, either throughout the day or from day to day. But like when you're pre-fishing or when you're putting together a plan, I'm curious what your philosophy is, or just looking back on some of your tournaments, you know, how often, or what would be some scenarios where, you know, you maybe you find an area that's got, you know, the fish, the tournament grade fish that you're looking for in it, and it's probably set up for a north wind. When the south wind comes, how often do you try to find those fish with that south wind, or how often do you just have to go find a south wind spot?
Yeah, so I get exactly what you're saying. The nowadays with forward facing sonar, I will go find those fish again.
Okay.
If I get a north wind beating into a spot and I found them up shallow the day before, usually now you got a south wind, I'll go find those fish again. I mean, it's really hard. It was really hard before forward facing sonar. And if you took forward facing sonar away, like if they just took them away from tournaments nowadays, I would go find those fish again, because now I know what they do. When back then I had no idea what they were doing. You know, it's
right.
It's crazy how much we learn with forward facing sonar, that it, even if you did take it away in tournament fishing, what we know is gonna, and what people that don't do it don't know, or aren't that great at it don't know, is still gonna keep us doing very well in tournaments. And yeah, that's, it's crazy what you can do with forward facing sonar, like saying that you're gonna go find fish with a different wind again, and you always have your milk run the spots, and it's constantly changing conditions. And I've even had days where I had one tournament this year, I had a really hard southeast wind, and a lot of guys can actually, they know the same thing happened to them. And until like 1 o'clock, we all had a southeast wind, really hard, and it laid flat. And I took off because I knew immediately what they were doing when it laid flat. And I watched 5 other guys that are really great fishermen take off from what we were all doing. And I'm like, they know too. They know what these fish are about to do. And we all went out into the deep water, and these fish rose off the bottom. In the snap of your fingers, they rose off the bottom, and then they were everywhere. And we all crushed them. I mean, I weighed 35 pounds that day, and some anglers were well over 40 pounds. And it was all in the snap of the fingers, just knowing what these fish do with different conditions. And we can find them now. We can track them down with forward-facing sonar. It's crazy.
Talking about wind and what that does to the fish, there's a lot of, you know, great opinions formulated over, you know, huge careers and great experiences, but there's slightly different takes on wind and what wind does to fish. Like, for you and your observation, do you feel like wind or lack of wind, like it moves fish, or more so those fish are there and it just sort of activates them in a certain way? Like what's your perspective on that? Like, how much are these fish moving, in your opinion, based on the wind and those kind of conditions?
It really depends on the body of water. So this is the biggest thing that you got to look at, is some bodies of water, it's not really, is the wind affecting the walleyes, or is the wind affecting the bait?
Mm.
And that's one of the biggest things on it's, and that's a time of year thing too.
Sure.
You know, you get wind crashing in on a rock pile and it's throwing all this bait up there. Well, obviously all these fish are going to move up shallow up there. And then the wind starts to calm down and all the bait can push out from the rock pile from that shallow water. And that's what it does. It pushes out and it goes out into the middle of no man's land and off this rock pile in 30 feet of water. And they were just in 3. And then it just sits out there and the bait swims freely. Well, then the walleyes will switch off and they'll go back. They'll go out there and everybody's like, man, the walleyes went out there because the wind stopped. Well, the walleyes went out there, yeah, because the wind stopped, but their bait went out there too. And that's another huge thing. And I've also seen it the other way around where it kind of blew my mind. I'm like, well, I think the wind was kind of, it was keeping them pinned to the bottom and they were just being lazy. And all of a sudden it got nice out and it got really hot out. And you see a lot of fish nowadays in the middle of the water column, which is one of the, a huge thing that we all didn't really know without forward facing sonar. Besides, when we pulled cranks on boards, you got them away from the boat and you pulled them halfway through the water column and you stuck a few pigs every now and then. But you don't really notice how many actually are in the middle of the water column. It's incredible. And sometimes I think they're just suntanning themselves. And you get a windy day and they're like, oh, can't tan today and we're going down to the bottom. So there's a lot of factors to it. But when I see a lot of fish in bait, you know, that's when I see the changes with the wind affecting the bait and where the fish set up more than the wind affecting just the fish.
Right on. It's great perspective. I know there's a, you know, again, going back, you know, 3, 4, 5, 10 years, like when people started to kind of get into the whole suspended fish deal, is there kind of an association that you make whatsoever with the suspended fish? Like, you know, one thing that I hear a lot or have heard a lot over the years is like, you know, if there's structure around and the walleyes are up shallow, or say the good structure is in the summertime is say around a thermal climb that's, you know, 30 feet down or whatever, do you feel like those fish, when they go and suspend, that they stay at that distance or at that part of the water column? Or do you feel like it's not quite so simple?
Yeah, it definitely, you know, I've seen it where they kind of will swim all over. A lot of mayfly hatches and really big pods of bait, they'll swim all over that water column. They'll go down into the thermal climb. I mean, a lot of people say that no fish live down in there, but I watched them last week, and actually I watched a ton of them swimming right in the thermal climb. And that, like, when it was a mayfly hatch, I see them run around a lot. But if you get, like, let's say you get wind crashing in on the rock pile and you got those fish up shallow, and then it just lays flat, like in the snap of the fingers, those fish will come off that rock pile. Even let's say the rock pile is 5 feet, they'll come off that rock pile and they'll stay at 5 feet, and it could be 40, 50, 60 feet below them, and they'll literally just coast and stay at 5 feet. So yeah, I see it a lot where they will literally stay at that level, and it seems like they'll stay at that level till they run into the next rock pile.
Huh, that makes a lot of sense. Now, getting a bit, you know, back into this season a little bit, I mean, you know, I don't want to jinx anything or, you know, whatever. You know, we're three quarters of the way through the regular season of the NWT, and you are on top of the Angler of the Year points. Tell me a little bit about the NWT season so far this year and how it's been going and how some of those bites were. I mean, I'm not trying to dive into your secrets too much, but anything that you're willing to share so far on this year that's been fun, maybe some things that you're still learning with Forward Sonar, some of the interesting takeaways.
Yeah, no, it's been an incredible year, and it's been awesome. I can't believe it. I mean, it's been a lot of fun, and you know, it felt like towards the end of last year, I finally got really, really good at the forward facing sonar thing. And I was like, I think I got it down now. I think I really, really, really got it down now. And it took a couple of years, you know, to get it down. Then coming into this year, I was pumped up, you know, going to Erie, which I fished one other time, and my dad's fished it a ton, and knowing how those fish set up, knowing what I need to look for, knowing that it's a big basin lake that, you know, I mean, you got spawning fish moving into an area, but it's their basin fish. They school up and they swim around together, and it's kind of like Lake of the Woods is a huge go find the pot of fish. And so I was really comfortable fishing those fish, and you know what, pre-fish was awesome, and it took till a couple days before the tournament before I really knew that I had it down. And it's super fun just to break down these bodies of water and succeed while you're doing it. And then going to Red Wing was probably one of the sketchiest tournaments for me. You know, I'm 35 minutes away from it. I fish it all spring long when the fish are up in the river. And I feel like a lot of people are like, oh, you better do good in this one. I'm like, man, I don't fish this body of water rarely ever. Once opener hits, I'm to the lakes, and I'm as far away as I can from a river. And to break that body of water down at that time of year, a time of year that I had really no idea what I was getting myself into, was awesome. You know, I went to the lake and I figured, you know what, I'm a way better lakes fisherman than I am a river fisherman. And yeah, there's current out here, but you know, I took what I've learned from other lakes, and I kind of said, hey, if I can find these things, I bet you I can find some walleyes. And it worked out really well. And yeah, that was pretty cool. And then going to Green Bay, you know, I've always wanted to fish a tournament on Green Bay, and I never have. And going into an NWT for your first tournament on Green Bay was a little
little crazy. And I, you know, I've been following Green Bay all my life. I kind of know that guys make huge runs, and Green Bay was I made a big gamble. You know, sometimes you gotta, when you're not super, super confident in something, or you're not really, really dialed in on it, but you know, you can gamble a little bit and maybe you can come out really well, is kind of what I did at Green Bay. And yeah, it's been an incredible year. I've been super pumped, you know, doing podcasts, and it's just kind of, I'm here, and I'm ready to do this. I know it's what I want to do. And I was born to fish, so I'm pretty pumped.
Yeah. When the shoe fits, right. I was going to ask you, like, you know, you're only in your second season. Who do you travel with? I mean, I know that's such a big thing, you know, in the NWT, especially guys, you know, just the guys have their travel team. Do you travel with anybody? Who is it?
Yeah. So I travel with, a couple of years ago when we first started to go do this thing, me and my buddy Will Pappenfist, we always looked at each other and said, dude, let's go do this. We can do this. And he's like, I'm not doing it as a co, because leading up to this, I know I'm good enough to fish against these guys. And he's like, all right, let's go do this. So me and Will went and we said we were locked in to do it. And then he knew a few guys, Max Wilson and Owen Wilcox, and that was kind of the team. We're like, all right, we got a team, let's go. And yeah, so it's me, Will Pappenfist, Max Wilson, Owen Wilcox, and then we had a few other buddies join last year, Cody Pixley and JJ DeBernardi, which is super cool. I mean, it's a great team. We have a lot of fun. I think we have a little more fun than just about everybody else, because we're just a bunch of young guys, and we have a blast. It's a great, great, great group of guys. Just breaking about down a body of water with these guys is incredible. I mean, we all have our strengths, and then when you put these strengths together, it's crazy. You definitely gotta have a good group of guys, and you gotta have a good group of guys that believes in you, and they help you out. You know, my first year was horrible on the National Walleye Tour, and I mean, they talked me into fishing the way that I fish. You know, it's you gotta have a good group of guys to travel with. That's key.
You feel like, I mean, what would be some things, you know, like some stories about the fishing with you guys, like things that you've learned from your teammates and maybe vice versa that have been really fun and impactful that you'll, you know, that you feel like have really gained your confidence and brought you guys together?
The biggest things that I've learned fishing as a team is, I don't even know. It's crazy. Some guys that will only throw one bait, and you'll only throw one bait. And you're like, I like this bait. And they're like, well, I like this bait. And then all of a sudden it's like, all right, well, I'm going to get in the boat and you're going to show me how you're throwing that bait, and you get in my boat and I'm going to show you how I'm throwing this bait. And then we got two baits that we're both confident in.
Yeah.
And that's one big thing, you know. We all have our strengths, and then that's huge. Like, well, you're catching them in the weeds. Well, how the heck are you catching them in the weeds? Get in the boat. Let's go. I'll show you. And then you show them, and then it's like, all right, well, how are you catching them out deep? And you show them, and like, oh my God, you learned so much. It's crazy when you got guys that have strengths in every category, and you could just bounce ideas off each other. That's probably one of the biggest things, you know. I mean, me and Will, we've known each other for a really long time, and I'm just saying, but I used to whoop on Will all the time and in some of these tournaments, and then all of a sudden he forward faces sonar, he started whooping on me really hard, and I'm like, oh man, I'm not gonna let you do that. So I'm like, hey, show me what the heck you're doing.
Yeah.
I'm like, and that was a big part of, hey, learning live scope, you know. It's really hard to do by yourself, and I was determined to learn it by myself. But you gotta have a great group of guys that can teach you every little thing. And nowadays I even find that I'm even teaching them stuff when they kind of got me to where the point where I'm at. Like Isaac Lakich, he's still by far one of the best live scopers, I think. And he taught me a ton. I mean, a lot about live scoping. And that was definitely key. I give him a lot of credit, but I kind of feel like now I'm showing him a few things. So it's super cool to just have a group of guys that you trust and you can bounce ideas off of.
Man, I think that's a big part of this forward sonar era that we're in. Is like, you know, people talk about, you know, young guys doing really well with it, you know, just be, you know, it kind of blaming it on age a little bit, where, you know, the guys that have been around for a long, long time, you know, just aren't picking up on the technology. I don't think it's the technology's fault. I think a lot of old time anglers are still in this mindset that a lot of fishing needs to be a secret. You don't share, you know, full information all the time, right? Like, isn't, you know, people don't share spots, you know, I'm not even talking tournament angling. I'm just mean like, you know, some of my best friends growing up, it's like, I wouldn't even share them, you know, these great spots that my dad and I found last weekend, you know, it's like, there's just sort of that inherent part of more traditional or old school mindset or approach to fishing where, you know, you try to figure these things out entirely on your own. But I think where the younger generation does really excel in their learning curve with forward sonar is that their guys are so much, especially younger guys, I think it's true. And you look across the whole industry, like the bass world and everywhere, that forward sonar is a thing. You know, people learning from each other and getting in each other's boats and really sharing that information, you know, two heads is better than one, where, you know, historically, you know, a lot of great advancements in technology or methods or strategy, you know, like, you know, guys could put their head down and figure it out on their own. And then when they figured it out, it was their own thing.
Yeah.
And they could excel with it, and you could win tournaments on, you know, on a thing. You know, if you could figure out how to leverage, you know, you look back on like slow death, you know, and a half a crawler, it's like, you know, for how long were those guys bending their own hooks and not telling anybody about that, you know, and, you know, you could just do things like that, but forward sonar, if you want to be good at it, you know, especially in a tournament setting, but just at all, if you want to be on a high level, it's a big investment, so you might as well get your money's worth. I think if you're the type of person that's, you know, always done things yourself, you consider yourself, you know, kind of an above average angler, you know, if there was ever a time to, you know, hire a guide or get a lesson, now's the time. Right. It's like, you know, you've probably been winning your own home lake derbies for the last 20 years, but all of a sudden you can't get a top five, and, you know, you blame it on the fish or you blame it on these young guys that just kind of know and understand the technology. Well, the technology doesn't care how old you are. Like, there's no, I think it's literally just the personality of, you know, young guys love to chop it up together. Young guys have fun fishing. Young guys will jump in each other's boats and they'll bounce those ideas off. It's way easier to think outside the box. You know, we don't want to have those, you know, those memories in our head that we just can't get off of. And then just the pride thing. It's like, you know, there's just a lot of, when I see guys that are struggling with it and are maybe, you know, just not super into the technology and they're kind of pessimistic about it and just aren't fully on board with it. I think a lot of it is that they're just missing out on the opportunity to ask more questions. You know, the kind of guys that just, you know, feel like they need to be a lone wolf. I think that's a big part of it. That's a big takeaway when I listen to you talk about learning it. Like, I need to factor in more days for myself. If I'm going to learn this on my own, I need to factor in, like, you know, who can I get in touch with? Like, who's around me that's doing it really, really well? And what do I, you know, what do I got to give them? You know, what do I got to do to ask for a half a day on the water? You know, I think that's where it really sets itself apart. For the sake of time, I don't want to take your whole day up, unless something else is eating at you as far as an update or anything like that, or how the fishing has been or any advice or recommendations. You can go ahead on that. Otherwise, you know, we can probably sign this off, man. I really appreciate it. I love the information. And I love learning more about you. I know you're in your second season of the NWT, but man, you've been fishing tournaments for a long time and you've had some great finishes,
for a long time on big bodies of water against good competition. So you're obviously not new at this. You know, I think, you know, maybe somebody might be looking at your sophomore season and think that there's a little bit of luck going on. Well, there's always luck, but man, you've been doing this for a piece. So I appreciate the conversation. I love the stories and the reflection and everything else. So yeah, unless something's eating at you, promote yourself, promote your socials or any content that you want to throw out there. If anybody ever had any questions or just wants to follow along on your exploits, you know, go ahead, man. Where can people find you?
Yeah, no, I got 180 Fishing on Instagram, and then 180 on Facebook and 180 Fishing. And then that's pretty much all I'm on. And, you know, it is kind of eating at me. You hit it on the head with the forward facing sonar thing, learning from other people. And I just want to say that all of us young guys, we learn from each other, and we're not just taking it away and running with it. We'll teach people how to use it. And Isaac Lackage Fishing, and he's a guide on Green Bay. He teaches guys every day how to use forward facing sonar, and we're here. I teach guys all the time how to use it. I mean, it this whole year I've taught a ton of guys how to use it, and it's excelled them to a huge extent. It's incredible. You know, we're all here to learn it, and we're not just sitting here like acting like the only guys that know it. We'll teach it. We're here to Tom Wynn. He talked about it this year. He's going to be teaching guys how to forward facing sonar all summer, I think he said, or all next summer. He's gonna show his secrets he's talking. And it's just because, you know, we know that you can't really fish without it, you can't really compete without it. So we're gonna show people how to use it and how you can compete with us. We're not just gonna run away with it, and that's one big thing, and that's all I really have to say about it.
Yeah, man, definitely moving the industry forward into the next, yep, into the next phase. There's no question about it. And man, I'm not gonna lie, I still do a fair amount of rigging bait. I love rigging a big minnow and getting a big walleye to bite it. So you know what, I'm gonna go see how much 4-pound test I have, and I'm gonna see if I can do it. I'm gonna send you a picture before the end of the summer, you watch. And
4-pound test.
Yeah, I'm gonna try to catch a big fish on a big minnow someday this summer. And I'll send you a picture, man. I'll send you a picture.
That's the hook hard and loosen your drag after, because he's going to run.
right on. I appreciate it all.
I appreciate you having me on here.
Yeah, dude. Awesome. Well, good luck the rest of the season. We'll definitely be watching. I know.